Welcome. You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for Hobby Radio, read by Keith, amateur radio operator W0NX, featuring the August 2024 The Spectrum Monitor. To begin, we'll finish Quick Looks, Stamful Wave Block Preselector, ICOM ICR15 Scanner, AOR ARDV10 2024 version, by George Viesela. SDR Play ACARS plugin, sdrplay.com/SDR Uno-ACARS-plugin. The AOR ARDV10 digital wideband receiver. It is more than 5 years now since the AOR, Authority on Radio, ARDV10 digital receiver hit retailer shelves here. In June 2024, popular UK radio retailer Moonraker advertised a new version of this radio with firmware 2307A. According to the latest AOR release notes of February 6, 2024, this firmware update is about the following. Functions: COSPAS monitoring regarding the aviation user type, the last five digits of the 15 hex ID now represent the location information and the aircraft's tail number. However, the decoded information is not displayed. This update applies only to users who activated the optional COSPAS SAR-SAT beacon decoder function. Bug fixes. AOR resolved an issue where turning the power off and then on again during a scan operation, with bank link enabled, would cause the system to start scanning at startup without engaging bank link. A fuller record of past and present firmware updates for this high-level scanner can be found at the AOR Firmware Archive. Another look at a remarkable radio. This summer, with both air shows and radio rallies now in full swing, was a good time to look at this handheld multi-talent once again as it presents itself now, with new firmware and improvements. For reasons of space, I am not going to reinvent the wheel. Much of what a reviewer stated in 2019, Radio User, February 2019, still holds true. I would like to refer you back to that very comprehensive review in terms of all the technical details of this receiver, its accessories, controls, and so on. Moreover, an in-depth manual is available on the AOR Japan download page. At the time of writing, in July 2024, there was also some supplementary documentation available regarding new features, for example, improvements to recording IQ data on an SD card, and playback with SDR Sharp software from firmware version 1810A onwards. Features, standard and pro. At present, some other optional and chargeable pro features of the ARDV10 include a Tetra GSSI user group filter and a COSPAS SAR-SAT, PLB, EPIRB, and ELT distress beacon decoder for 121.5 and 406 MHz. But first, let's recap the key specs and stats of the DV10 and digest some comments made by earlier reviewers. The AOR DV10, do not confuse it with the base station AOR ARDV1, covers 100 kHz to 1300 MHz in WFM, NFM, AM, LSB, USB, and LSB, and CW analog, as well as Tetra direct mode, DMR Tier 1, 2, Moto TRBO, NXDN 6.25K, DPMR 446 Tier 1, APCO25 Phase 1 DS. Optically, the receiver is a large handheld, It offers 2,000 memories in 40 banks of 50, CTCSS and DSC decoding, and a multitude of search modes, squelch types, and scanning methods. These include bank link scanning and what I would call bookend searching, where you search between two frequency edges you have put in. This is the one feature that most of you might use most, and the AR-DV10 excels at it. The AOR-AR-DV10 also has an onboard analog voice descrambler. Importantly, you can record signals to a micro SD card, an essential function for any scanner these days. The 2019 reviewer was happy with basic SINAD, signal-to-noise and distortion ratio measurements, and 5 years later, the sensitivity of the set has, if anything, improved further. The automatic detection of the digital transmit format is a great bonus and will make life so much easier. In this area, the AR-DV10 arguably sets the bar for others to follow. Scanner hobbyists are likely to take note of the innovative COSPAS-SARSAT reception feature and the PLB, EPIRB, and ELT distress beacon decoder. The emergency comms monitoring and maritime radio aspects of our hobby are experiencing a renaissance at the moment, and I can see these features being popular with enthusiasts. Overall conclusions. The Stanfill WaveBlock is a modern, professional-grade preselector which will grace the shack of any broadcast signals, DXers, radio amateurs, and utility monitors. It is flexible and represents quality made in Switzerland at an affordable price. Performance with both legacy radios and modern SDRs is flawless. WaveBlock might well help you dig that last ounce of signal out of the mush, and it looks great in the shack too. If you enjoy working with preselectors, you should consider getting this one. At the time of writing in June 2024, the WaveBlock was available in the online shop at Stanfill Hamm Electronic for 590 Swiss francs, about 520 pounds, or 660 US dollars. The ICOM ICR-15 is a pared-down, analog-only scanner with a narrow frequency range and no inbuilt decoders, bandscope view, or add-ons. It is sensitive, simple, and intuitive to use. It will appeal to beginners, airshow visitors, marine monitors, and general hobbyists looking for a lightweight, portable scanning hobby solution. However, the ICR-15 will have to find its place in a market of competing SDRs and scanners, which also offer digital scanning at a similar or just slightly higher price point. E.g., the Uniden UBCD3600XLT, Whistler TRX-1, and others. The ICOM ICR-15 currently retails for 449.95 pounds in the UK. The 2024 version of the AOR-AR-DV10 is a very advanced wideband receiver, which aims at being a one-stop solution for your reception and monitoring requirements. The issues surrounding sensitivity and frequency drift that were raised in connection with earlier versions of this receiver have been ironed out. However, in my view, the DV10 is not a beginner's scanner, but rather an advanced signals analysis machine. The more you put into learning how to operate this radio, the more you will get out of it, especially in terms of the new functions advertised at the time of writing. Stateside, the AOR-AR-DV10 is available at Ham Radio Outlet, hamradio.com, as a special order item, discounted to $1,650. My sincere thanks go to Jez Fox and Justin Godfrey at Moonraker, Ian Lockyer at ICOM UK, Tony Wiltshire at Martin Lynch & Sons, and Heinz Stompfel at Stompfel Ham Electronics for the kind and generous loans of the review units, for answering my questions, and for providing much valued advice. And now, Amateur Radio Insights by Kirk Kleinschmidt, NT0Z, NT0Z at stealthamateur.com. Underground Experimentation. Amateur radio is a wide-ranging collection of loosely related hobbies that has become more fractious in recent decades, perhaps accelerating since 1991, when the Morse code requirement for licensure was eliminated. Until then, every U.S. radio amateur had to pass a Morse code test commensurate with each license class. Whether you knew it fast or slow, you had to know it. I think this contributed to a certain level of shared feelings and experiences among hams. There were, of course, other factors that made the community smaller and the experiences of individual members more similar. Digital modes and modes in general were fewer. Radios were more alike than not. Some cost more than others, to be sure, but for decades, a rig was pretty much a rig. Repeaters used analog FM voice. Computers didn't yet play a major role in amateur radio. Before I get too far into a dreamlike reverie, my point is that back in the day, the vast majority of hams experienced a certain knowledge and experience core. It doesn't exist across all ham groups in the same way today. Today's amateur radio is much more stratified. Members of one interest group probably don't experience the hobby in the ways that other groups do, and vice versa. I have written about some of these differences for years. For example, newer hams who came up in the hobby in the past 20 years, the last couple of years excepted, never really experienced the glories of HF propagation with a functioning ionosphere. From approximately 2002 to 2021-2022, HF was mostly deadsville. Antennas have a similar story. With the rise of HOA encumbered properties and a general disdain in the population for external antennas, external anything, hams who came up during those same doldrum decades often didn't experience amateur radio with a decent normal HF antenna. I'm talking about a wire dipole at 50 feet and not a six-element Yagi atop a tall tower. As expected, if you don't have a tower, for example, you probably don't know too much about tower installation, thrust bearings, rotators, guy anchors, guy wires, etc. This only makes sense. These knowledge gaps provide ample opportunities to learn new skills, make new friends, etc. I learned about 48-foot Rhone lattice towers as a teenager because I had a part-time job installing them while working for two local TV repair shops. If you purchased a tower and installation today, you probably couldn't imagine that a 16-year-old kid, barely able to legally drive, would show up driving a pickup truck and pulling your new tower, tools, a cement mixer, bags of 4,000 PSI sacrete, all on a flatbed trailer. And just when you thought that the kid was simply delivering your goodies, he confirmed the location for your new tower and started digging the 4x4x4-foot hole. Is he mixing cement, you might wonder? Yep. I wasn't allowed to erect the towers by myself because, for safety and other logical reasons, that's a two-person job. But I was one of the two people. I wore a beefy leather lineman's belt so I could strap on at working height, now considered hopelessly outdated. And I survived without incident. Because these were fringe area TV installations, my experience also extended to low-end TV rotators. But all of these installs were directly adjacent to houses or cabins, so none of the coax or control lines had to be buried. That's an experience gap that exists to this day. As detailed here in recent columns, I recently took a wide-ranging journey of discovery and new skill cultivation in the process of learning about, installing, and repairing the GPS-disciplined oscillator that helps my lab-grade frequency counter remain accurate despite its age, 50 years. Among other useful things, I had to learn and practice soldering and unsoldering tiny surface mount devices, This was something I'd been putting off for far too long. With internet-based mentoring, it's easier than ever to learn about almost any aspect of amateur radio and come out the other end of the learning process with useful new skills or a new ham radio pursuit. After 47 years in the hobby, I find myself more willing than ever to learn new things, experience new modes, do new stuff. In that sense, then, this month's learning journey focuses on coaxial cable, but not in the usual ways. As a reader, you may remember that I'm a longtime user of 75-ohm CATV coax, whether RG6 or RG11, love the stuff, or that I'm a fan of homebrew open-wire feed lines, ditto. But this month, I'm mostly focusing on what to do with said coax in an underground sense, and not necessarily which type to use, etc. First, a confession. A personal confession. For decades, most of my antennas have been indoors or attached to supports, even towers, that were themselves attached to the building that housed my shack. The coax that feeds attic antennas, for example, never goes outside. And for most of the outside installations, the coax goes out the window or through some other cable via and straight up to the antenna, but not on the ground. The confession, then, is about the antennas farther out, away from said buildings. To this day, at this moment, and for decades, my farther-out antennas have been fed by coax and/or accompanying control lines or rotator cables that are simply lying on the ground. Say what? Minnesota's climate is varying and extreme. The cables are exposed to the weather, sun, UV, winter, temps down to negative 25°F, rain, foot traffic, attention from rodents and other creepy crawlies, being driven over by riding and push mowers, and probably more. Heck, I cut one with a snowblower one winter when we had so much snow that I had to snowblow a moat around my entire house and deck to avoid spring flooding. Is running the cables on the ground a good idea? Almost certainly not. But as evidenced by my logbooks over the decades, the low-tech approach did work from an RF and DC perspective. I replaced the cables periodically, carefully checking the jackets for problem areas, which I did before they showed any performance or water incursion effects. But when using RG6 and RG11 CATV cable, which can be sourced free or nearly so, it's not like I was replacing runs of expensive Belden or Times Microwave 50-ohm cable. At HF, RG6 and RG11 have performance specs that meet or even noticeably exceed those of RG8, RG213, and even LMR400-grade cables. So with hundreds to thousands of feet on hand at all times, from scrounging and horse trading, I simply didn't worry about it. Other things such as floods, surgeries, and crosstown moves had also pushed the on-the-ground cable issues further down the to-do list. In the back of my mind, however, I had always wanted to address my outdoor cabling issues, but one factor finally convinced me to bury the runs. I had been systematically making changes in the yard, near decks, around trees, etc., to make the yard easy to mow. With an acre of grass and an unwillingness to rewild the majority of the space, setting things up for easy mowing saved a lot of time and allows most of the work to be done from the comfort of the riding mower, as opposed to the electric push mower, which is only, hopefully, used for trimming here and there. The first cable run to be addressed is a 50-footer from the side of the house to the feed point of my backyard inverted L verticals. An insulated box there houses an auto tuner and a big relay. To mow the lawn in that region, I had to move the cables back and forth, which was tedious. Mow here, move cables to the now short grass, mow there, again and again. Plus, when moving the cables back and forth, I'd sometimes jostle the insulated box out of position on its mount. Grr. The look and feel of having the cables on the ground was also a minor factor, but this area is in the antenna farm portion of the property. I keep the entire front yard pristine, so my long-suffering YL can sit on the deck under the shade of a big umbrella, see only her plants in a beautifully manicured lawn, and hear the gentle ringing of her big wind chimes. Bliss! But if she goes around the far corner of the house, all bets are off. I needed to bury the cables, but I also needed to do it affordably, because my play money this season was earmarked for insulating and sheetrocking my outer garage, which is really a shop space that wants to be year-round. It's probably not obvious to everyone, but in cold climates, if you can work year-round in your shop, it effectively doubles the time you can spend doing things there. And if you're a semi-senior like me, doubling shop time availability is like adding another 10-plus years to my ability to do stuff there, which is a freaky concept to someone who is much younger. Me included until recently. I have my electronics shop in the basement, but I don't have table saws and other big tools there, so getting the spare garage squared away now tops the to-do list. Underground experimentation. I'm sure there are many, but I don't know any nearby hams who have buried cable runs. But I have listened to the chatter and picked up a few pointers over the years. And before we explore my process, let me remind you that my cables have simply been lying on the ground forever. That's the baseline. It wasn't cool, but it worked fine, subject to the issues mentioned above. Conduit types. Like underground AC service drops, most cable runs are buried in some sort of PVC pipe or conduit. Now, if you're burying a single run of 12-2 house wire, that conduit can be quite small in diameter, even less than an inch. But if you want to make room for several coaxial cables and a few control lines for relays, rotators, and remote sensors, a 3-inch conduit seems future-proof. Various building codes, which I completely ignored for this project since there is no high-voltage AC inside, may call for certain PVC or ABS materials, etc. I initially looked for the most affordable 3-inch PVC, whatever flavor, that I could find. And because I'm sort of stuck in 1989 when it comes to estimating material cost, I was shocked to see that 3-inch PVC pipe was weighing in at about $15 for a 10-foot length, and I'd need about 100 feet of straight pipe, plus a handful of elbows and similar goodies. Not impossible, but not casual. I looked for used PVC on Craigslist and Facebook Marketplace, but there were no sellers nearby that had anything larger than an inch or so. Because, as mentioned, this is an experiment, I settled on 3-inch corrugated drainpipe. A 100-foot length was $42. I had used the stuff to manage multiple emergency sump pump outlets during the 2019 flood, and a few lengths that had been sitting outside for 5 years, downspout extensions, showed no signs of deterioration. Plus, this stuff is easy to work with. It's flexible and can easily be spliced, etc. Initial experimental conditions met. Solid or perforated? Corrugated drain pipe comes in solid and perforated varieties. But which to use? A solid, sealed, waterproof conduit initially seems to be the best choice, but there might be ample reasons to use perforated pipe, just like the stuff that was used in the new perimeter sump system in my basement after the flood. We'll continue this article next time. Thank you for joining us for Hobby Radio, read by Keith.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.